Chapter 10. Atonement. Small Lives. Lords of War. Strike Frigate Persephone. Outer Solar System. The last defenders of Pluto fled towards the light of the sun. Ragged, scarred, and with the blood of battle still marking their decks, they kept on. Where there had been hundreds, now there were barely enough to make a lone hundred. The Ophelia and Persephone circled their sisters and cousins, watching the fleet and the void around them. They could not see their pursuers, but they knew they were there. Axemand had suffered catastrophic losses, but new ships were still coming from the warp. There would be hunters at their backs, swift ships with cruel intent. Some of the survivors fell even as they fled. Engines failed, wounded hulls broke apart under the stress of acceleration. The Sword Sister, which had endured battles since the first decades of the Great Crusade, became a silent hulk, ploughing on for hours on momentum. The Sign of Truth peeled away from the pack as its damaged reactors began to overload. The light of its death chased its surviving kin. On they ran, through the Gulf of Night, their hulls creaking with damage, their human crews feeling their world shake, the Legion-born warriors pulling broken armour from wounded muscles. Past the wrecked ships of all the invaders and usurpers who had fallen in the long millennia since humanity had first left its cradle. In the hold of the Persephone, Sigismund paused on the threshold of the sanctuary. His armour hung from him in torn shards, grinding as he moved. Blood caked his tabard and had clotted inside the plates. He felt cold. The hot beat of the pulse in his veins quieted after the roar of battle.
"It is what awaits us all in the end," said Fafnir Ran from beside him. "By sword or bullet, it's coming for us all."
Sigismund looked up at the captain of the assault carder. Blood and damage painted Ran's armour too, and dried blood masked half of his face.
"He chose how to meet it. There is nothing more any of us could ask."
Ran paused, holding Sigismund's gaze with his own.
"And nothing more you can give him."
Sigismund gave a small nod and keyed the door release. The space beyond was small and the light low. Stone-clad walls climbed to an arched roof. The names of every warrior who had ever called the ship home and died in battle marched over every surface, incised in gilded letters. The doors sealed behind Sigismund. The low, rasp thump of machinery beating a dual pulse filled the quiet. The remains of a figure lay under a shaft of dim light. They had tried to cut him from his armour, but armour and flesh could not be separated without ending what the sons of Horus had begun. Tubes and pipes led from blocks of machinery and jars of dark fluid. The rattling bubble of breath, drawn by a machine through fluid-filled lungs, rose and fell in time with the pulse and thud of the tubes. Sigismund stepped forwards. His armour growled. Something in the mass of sticky flesh and torn ceramite flickered and opened. The sounds bubbled out. After a second, Sigismund realized it was a word, pulled out of the figure letter by letter as the machine gave it breath. "Lord." He knelt then, servos grinding, his gaze fixed on Boreas's eye.
"No," he said. "I am no lord here, my brother."
"You,"
began Boreas.
"You live."
Sigismund nodded.
"And the tech priests."
"I know. I will not go to the Iron Sleep," said Boreas.
Sigismund shook his head. There would be no rebirth as a dreadnought for Boreas, no half-life of metal and war until he died a second time. Sigismund bowed his head.
"Why?"
The word brought his head up. Boreas's eye was fixed on him, bright and unblinking.
"Why did you want to die?"
He saw the flash in his mind of the blades and faces of the Sons of Horus. So many. Too many.
I began Sigismund,
and now it was his words that faltered. He closed his mouth. The hiss, thump, and gurgle filled the moment.
Atonement, he said at last.
For what?
For an oath broken, said Sigismund.
The gaze of Boreas did not shift as he spoke, and the machines beat out the seconds. And Sigismund found himself speaking. He spoke of Euphrates Kela, of the days after the first word of Horus's treachery had found dawn. He spoke of a vision she had given him of the future, and the choice that went with that vision. To be here now, as the darkness came to swallow the sun and raise his sword against it, or to follow his Primarch's order and lead a fleet to strike at Horus in the earliest days of the war. He spoke of how he had chosen, and how he had returned with dawn to Terra, and when the fleet that was his to command was lost, how he had told Dawn about his reason for returning, and what he feared Keela's vision meant. And last he spoke of Dawn's wrath at the reason.
"You are not my son."
The words echoed again in his mind, and he fell silent before they could come from his mouth.
"I failed," he said. "And I swore I would never fail him again."
"You were right."
"That is not for us to judge."
"Death is not atonement," said Boreas. "Not even now. At the end."
Sigismund felt something cold tighten within him. Boreas's gaze had gone distant. The rhythmic beat of the pumps rose, laboring. The tubes and flasks gurgled and sputtered. The fluid in the jars was dark.
"You atone by living until the last blow of the sword."
Something in the ruin of meat and twisted armour shifted. It might have been a hand reaching to grasp, or just the shudder of life fleeing the will holding it.
"Until the last blow of the sword. Swear it to me."
"You have my oath," said Sigismund.
The machine stopped. A high wail replaced the bubbling hiss and thump.
"And you mine, my brother," said Boreas.
His eye flashed clear for a moment, his gaze steady as it held Sigismund's.
"Always."
Beyond the stone walls of the room, beyond the hull of the ship lancing through the void, beyond the ships of the fleet that followed it, the solar system turned on, silent and unceasing. Freighter ship Antaeus, Trans-Saturnian Gulf. Vec paused outside the stateroom door, his hand on the release. Around him, the hum of the ship passing through the void vibrated gently through the air. The lights in all the compartments and companionways had dimmed to the night cycle. Quiet shadows filled the edges of everything. Even on the bridge, the crew, still on watch, had talked little. Most had been stood down and gone to get some sleep. Vec hadn't, though. The thoughts that had followed him from the clamour and chaos of the flight from Uranus did not quiet in this time of silence. He had gone to check on his children and found them sleeping. Noon had been in his bunk, mouth wide, snoring, hands tucked under his head, and he had frowned and turned over as Vec had kissed him on the forehead. Mori was not in her bunk. She had taken her blankets and curled in the corner of the room. An autoscribe book had slipped out of her hands onto the deck. Vec had picked it up. She had sucked a breath, as if to call out, raised her head and looked as though she were about to open her eyes. Vec had frozen, and Mori's head had dropped back. After a moment, her breathing had fallen back to the slow rhythm of sleep. She was frowning, he noticed, and for a blink of his mind's eye, he saw the same expression cross his memory of her mother's face. He glanced at the words Mori had autoscribed across the page of the book.
I don't know where we are going,
it read.
No one is telling me. Maybe they don't want to say. Maybe they don't know.
He had looked at the words for a long while, and then put the autoscribe book back beside his daughter. He bent and kissed her lightly and went to the door. In the night-dimmed corridor, he rubbed the heels of his hands across his eyes. When he took them away, there were worms of neon light still clinging to his sight.
I don't know where we are going.
He should think. Try to think about what they would do when they reached Jupiter. Had the war reached there yet? Did they have enough food to make it? He swayed. He was tired. His feet started to move. He should sleep. But he would not. Could not sleep. Not now. He walked, and the ship shivered with a familiar rhythm that once would have given him comfort. He walked, and the world, and past, and questions turned in his head, until he found that he had stopped. He blinked at the doors of the staterooms in front of him. He began to wonder why he was here, but of course he knew why. He raised his hand and knocked.
"Mistress Hollerton," he said.
The door opened from the inside before he could knock again. The lights were on in the stateroom. Mercedes Hollerton looked at him. There was an expression on her face that he could not quite read. Sadness? Resignation?
"You have questions," she said,
and moved back to a chair set beneath a glow lamp. The bed had not been used, he noticed. She picked up a cup from a low table and put it to her lips. Steam and the smell of caffeine rose from it. He glanced at where the decorative samostil sat on a plinth at the other end of the room. An open tin of grounds sat beside it, some gritting the polished wood. There was a pop and a gurgle, and a curl of steam rose from a brass vent tube.
"I think that samostil is meant to be decorative," he said. "I have certainly never used it."
"Ah," said Mercedes. "That would explain why it took so long to get working."
He looked at her and thought he saw the ghost of a smile on her face.
"There seemed to be no shortage of caffeine, though."
"Part of the family business," he said. "We held the transit monopoly on Cadarine caffeine through Uranus orbits for 12 decades.
He trailed off, realizing that he was still standing by the open door.
"Do you want some?"
asked Mercedes.
"I think I made too much."
"No,"
he said, turning and closing the door.
"No, I think I might want to try to sleep later, but thank you. Too much of that and you won't sleep for days."
"That's what I'm hoping," she said.
They lapsed into silence as he sat on one of the other chairs. She took another drink from her cup and waited. He opened his mouth, not sure what he was going to say, but she spoke instead.
"You want to know about her, don't you? About Keela?"
He closed his mouth, then nodded.
"Yes,"
he said.
"You believe, don't you? You are a follower of the Lectitio Divinitatis?"
"My wife,"
he began, then paused, closing and opening his mouth.
"No, not really, but..."
"A dangerous thing to be part of a prescribed cult. Even worse if your soul isn't in it." Do I believe?" she said.
She smiled, took another sip from her cup, then gave a short laugh.
"I have seen things. When you know the truth, does that leave room for faith? Or does it become fact?"
"But Keela,"
he asked, and heard the hunger in the words as they came from his mouth.
"She is real, then. You knew her?"
Mercedes looked at him for a long moment, and then put the cup down.
"I owe you thanks, Master Vec. Thanks and apologies that you do not have to accept. But I can't offer you certainty. I can't even offer hope."
"You said, though, that you needed to reach the Praetorian, that the saint, that Keela..."
"Do you know what the Crusade and the betrayal have taught me?"
She was looking directly at him now, and there was a hardness in her eyes.
"We are small things, we humans. We mean very little. Our lives are narrow and short, and our dreams, even if noble, will not shift the stars in the sky. We are not the movers of this age. Horus is, and the Emperor, The choices and the hope and the ruin belong to them.
Vec breathed in sharply. His hands twitched. Mercedes did not move.
I'm sorry, Master Vec, she said. You asked about Keela, about what I am doing and why I am doing it. I thought you deserved an answer.
But you talk...
He paused, the fear taking the sounds of the name from his tongue.
You talk of the War Master, not the Saint.
Because if there are arch-traitors and saints, then hope is their realm, the realm of cosmic change and slaughter and sorrow. They are the ones who will decide tomorrow, and if there are any tomorrows after that. We are human, Master Vec. Our lives only matter in quantity. We can dream and despair and cling on to what we have, but those things live only in us. Our hope is our own, and if the universe cares, it does so by accident. That is why people pray to the Emperor and call my old friend a saint, because deep down they know that they cannot change the great course of events.
You have a very bleak view for someone claiming to be trying to help save the last fortress of humanity.
I have seen Horus, she said. I have heard his voice. One day everyone who can say that will be gone, and no one will remember. But I remember, and for years I have tried to hold on to that memory.
What? Why?
Because it matters. What I saw mattered. Horus was greater and more noble and more terrible than any human could ever be. It was not just the armies, you see. It was not just his sons. It was that he was something beyond us, something that spoke like us and wore a face that was like ours, but was from another order of existence. He existed in a greater way. The smallest things he did and choices he made could send cracks across the shell of life. He was a creature who turned, and half the galaxy turned with him.
And burned,
said Vec, and began to rise. He could feel a headache building at the edges of his eyes. This was not what he had come for, but it was his fault that he had come here at all.
I can't lie to you, she said. You have done too much for me, not to tell you what I believe, before you can choose what you believe. I can tell you that I am carrying information from my old friend, who is now the saint of a rogue cult that worships the Emperor as a god. A friend who spoke to me in dreams. You can hear that, and believe that I am carrying a message from the divine to a Primarch, that I am chosen, that this is something only I can do, that I do the will of the Emperor, and that he protects us. You can believe that you are doing good, that it will mean that everything is going to be all right.
She trailed off, shrugged. She looked very tired, he realized, drained in a way that he thought was deeper than a lack of sleep. She gave a half smile.
Or you can believe that I'm insane and dangerous, that it was the worst mistake of your life to help us, that it is all going to end badly. You can believe that instead.
She stood up and went to the Samastil and filled her cup again.
And all of those things might be true at the same time.
But you believe, he said.
I know I need to do what I can, and yes, I believe. I believe that we are small and that our dreams cannot change the stars. But sometimes our deeds can change the universe, even if it is only by accident. If you want to, you can find your hope in that.
Vec found that he was smiling.
And that is enough?
It is all we have, she said.
Vec stood, poured a cup of caffeine and winced.
Ugh, I always hated this stuff.
He stood and went to the door. He had his hand on the release, and the door opened when she spoke again.
Thank you, Master Vec.
For what?
He asked, half turning.
For believing?
He was still for a moment, not certain if he did believe, but knowing that he had made his choice.
You should sleep,
he said. and pulled the door shut behind him. Battle Barge War Oath, Supra Solar Gulf.
They come, whispered Abaddon to himself as he watched the enemy close.
The grey-white ships did not come as a single fleet, but in a wild, patternless rush. First came the blade of the Endless Horizon and its cast of torpedo frigates, burning on a spiralling path, loosing torpedoes seemingly at random, closing so fast that it seemed they would fly straight into the guns of Abaddon's fleet. They did not. As the first salvos from long-range batteries reached for them, they turned and scattered like droplets of water from forge-hot iron. The twin strike cruisers, Truth of the Wind and Storm Soul, cut in. Running side by side, they dived towards the armada, and then slammed out of their dives at the edge of the Sons of Horus's range. They cut laterally, spiralling and dancing as explosions chased them. Watching them in his helm display, Abaddon remembered a story told by Yoden Crowweaver of the Sixth. When ships would meet on the seas of Fenris, warriors would run the oars of the boats in full armour with weapons drawn, bounding from oar-haft to oar-haft as the sea rose and fell and their enemies watched. Even if one boat met 20 in a storm, still a lone warrior would run the oars. Abaddon had understood why.
To show their contempt of death, he had said. To show that even if cut down by greater numbers, they were still worthy of the life they led.
Yoden had shrugged and nodded.
Is there any other way to face death than by laughing?
The torpedoes loosed from the first attack wave struck their targets. Explosions blossomed across the armada's lead ships. Fire and plasma ripped wounds in armoured skin. In a dozen warships, thousands died in the pinprick flashes that sparkled in Abaddon's eyes.
No sign of the Lance of Heaven, he said into the vox. None yet, brother, came the reply from Krushan.
Abaddon had left helm command to the veteran line captain.
She will come, replied Abaddon. Commit as soon as she does. As you will it, brother.
Abaddon cut the vox, but kept the sensor feed running in the corner of his right eye as he stalked into the teleportation chamber. A throng of black-armoured warriors greeted him with raised fists and weapons. These were his finest, the elite of the First Company, Justerin, Reavers, and Deathmarked. All of them had fought at each other's side for years before the war, and had thrived in the battles that came after. There was Sykar, his lieutenant and commander of the components that would strike at their targets' engines and power conduits, grinning at Ralkor with sharp steel teeth. Tybar and his squad were fixing oath parchments to their bolters. Some wore talismans that showed they had founded alliances with one of the many faces of the powers of the warp. Abaddon moved amongst them, returning their greetings with a nod, pausing to grip the hand and wrist of Galteron, the young warrior still recovering from the wounds dealt to him in pursuit of the wolves during Beta Garmon.
My captain, said Galteron, bowing his head briefly.
Abaddon moved on, feeling the pre-battle tension rising and spreading through the force like a thunderhead before the storm. He smiled inside his helm. This was his home. In these moments, amongst these brothers and warriors, he felt the universe align, become clear, become as it should be. Erskar and Gedafron were standing together, serfs clustered around them as the last plates of their cataphracti armour were slotted into place. The breaches of Erskar's Reaper cannon cycled as boxes of heavy rounds locked into its loader. His crimson helm glinted with silver-filled scars, an echo of the face beneath. Gedafron was snapping the power field of his power mace on and off, flexing his grip and shoulders. They did not bow their heads as Abaddon approached, or show any sign of acknowledgement. They did not need to. They had fought at his side for longer than any other. They had saved his life, and he theirs. He was their captain, but they needed no sign to mark the bonds of respect and blood that bound them. Abaddon was about to speak, when he felt stillness ripple through the chamber. Gedafron's head jerked up, the rest of his body motionless.
The dogs of ashes,
he growled aloud. Abaddon turned, following his brother's gaze. Laak and his blade slaves walked across the deck. The chatter and bark of voices quieted. Eyes followed the three word-bearers. Abaddon waited, feeling the fire rise to his tongue and pulling his lips back from his teeth.
"Why are you here?"
Laak paused, looking around slowly.
"To face the enemy at your side," he said.
The room remained still. All it would take was the smallest gesture, not even a word, and the three word-bearers would be dead on the deck. Again the question of why he had let Laak remain with him surfaced in Abaddon's mind, and found no clear answer. He turned his back on them without reply, and blinked the ship's sensor feed so that it filled his right eye. The flash of explosions, hundreds of kilometres in size, replaced the sight of his brothers. The white scars were coming again, wheeling in, formations changing, ships moving between squadrons like birds spiralling on the wind. It was dazzling. 61 ships in the outer shell of the Armada had taken serious damage. This was the White Scar's purpose. Not to kill, unless they had a chance, but to slice 1,000 times so that the ships that struck the inner solar system would be already bleeding, already weak. The privateers and vagabond ships that had split from the Armada had drawn off much of the White Scar's void strength, but not enough. The grey and white ships had not taken the bait, but spun away, gathered, and come back at the main bulk of Abaddon's ships with fresh focus. That took vision and control that even the best Legion Void commanders would struggle to wield. Abaddon could ill afford to let their strength bleed away before they reached their true objective. So they would bring this dance to an end. Abaddon's armada did not halt. If it deviated from its path, it would lose the advantages brought by the blood and sorcery that had let it emerge so far inside the sphere of the solar system. So it fought as it ploughed on, a single vast beast tormented by the bites of the falcons that now spun across its path.
"That's the problem with that Chthonian directness you so value. It works too well."
Abaddon had let a spark of annoyance show on his face. Jubal Khan had just laughed and put a hand on his shoulder, as though they had known each other for decades.
"You get so used to using it, you forget that it is not the only way to kill."
Amongst the Sons of Horus ships in the outer layers of the Armada, one vessel started to list. It was named the Aeolus, a heavy cruiser, Mars-forged and spear-blade-hulled. Multiple torpedoes had slid through its shields and burst through its armoured flanks. Fire had spread through its starboard decks and compartments. Plumes of air flashed as they streamed through its void shields. Now it began to veer off course, engines stuttering and flaring. Its fleet sisters plunged on, not slowing as it struggled for direction and speed. The White Scar's ships circled as the wounded Aeolus fell away from its siblings. Its engines fired again, burning with star-bright desperation, like a wounded animal falling behind the safety of the herd, fighting against the inevitable as its killers watched and circled. But it wasn't dying. It was bleeding. But its weakness was feigned. The White Scars began to whirl inwards towards their kill. They drew together, and now amongst them, like a ghost gathered from the dark, was a great vessel, its engines tracing a bright sickle in the stars.
"The Lance of Heaven," breathed Abaddon,
as he saw the battle barge slide into sight. He thought of the Legion brothers that he had killed to see this sight, brothers slain on the Aeolus, as fire roared through its decks and explosions tore its skin. He had killed those warriors, he knew. The enemy had held the knife, but they had died because of him, for him, so that he could stand in this moment and see his opponent come from the ocean of night to meet him. There were wounds that could not be affected, prices that had to be paid in the only coin that mattered. The Lance of Heaven held fire as it closed. The Aeolus rolled, its engines misfiring and sending it spinning like an arrow loosed from a broken bow. The Lance of Heaven fired. Beams of plasma lashed across the night. The last of the Aeolus's void shields vanished. The wheeling ships hurled ordnance at it. Blisters of molten metal formed and burst on its hull. The Lance of Heaven kept closing. Shorter-ranged batteries opened up. The Aeolus spun on. Trunks of debris arced from its sides. Watching the exchange, Abaddon could almost see the White Scar's need for the kill driving them on. The Lance of Heaven curved close, burning hard to slice the fire of its broadside batteries across the Aeolus's engines. A final slice to leave it stricken in the void. It was a cut too far.
"Strike!"
Abaddon ordered. The War Oath speared forwards. The ships of the Armada that had shielded it parted. Power had built in its reactors, and the adepts of the new Mechanicum had held the fury of its plasma exchanges in balance until they screamed. Released, that power roared from its engines and plunged it towards the Lance of Heaven like a thunderbolt from a night sky. Heat and radiation killed hundreds on the engine decks. Three escort ships came with the War Oath, soaring wide to bracket their prey. Too late, the White Scar ship broke off its attack run and turned to dive back into the night. But the War Oath was already close enough. In the teleportarium, the air pulsed with static and ball lightning.
"For the War Master," said Abaddon into the vox,
and the ranks of warriors gathered around him vanished in a flash of strobing light. Warship Lance of Heaven, Suprasolar Gulf. The warriors in black appeared out of a whirl of green lightning in the passages of the Lance of Heaven's command castle. Abaddon felt sensation briefly drain from his limbs as reality slammed back into place around him. Gunfire met them as the teleport light vanished with a howl. Etheric blast waves ripped out, shrieking with the voices of human fear. The Sons of Horus fired back, blasting through defense turrets and bulkheads as they charged. There was no hesitation in their movements, no doubt. They read their surroundings and were moving and killing before the humans facing them had loosed more than a shot.
"Forwards!"
called Abaddon, firing and moving with his brothers. Squads clamped charges onto sealed bulkheads and spun aside as metal flashed to shrapnel and smoke. The men and women who opposed them were drilled and disciplined, recruited and bound to serve the White Scars with honour and skill at arms. But they were still mortal. Bodies exploded inside pressure suits as they were slammed into walls by explosions. Chain teeth carved through meat and bone. Blood slicked the decks. Bolt rounds filled corridors with shrapnel and pulped bodies. Within 3 minutes, strike forces had speared through the defences around critical locations across the Lance of Heaven's command castle and engine decks. Abaddon reached the main doors to the bridge as Ralkor, his signal master, was attempting a violation of the machine spirit governing its locks. Abaddon gave a single shake of his head and gestured with a digit of his power fist. Two Reaver squads ran forwards, pulling charges from backpacks and belts. The charges locked in place as Abaddon took his next step. His mind was cold, the progress of the assault a breath of thoughts at the back of his awareness. Resistance had been low, far too low for a capital ship of this size. The charges on the bridge doors detonated. Melter waves bored white-hot holes through the armour slabs a second before breaching charges cleaved through the warping metal. A squad of Terminators went through first, ramming through the cooling debris, firing as they advanced. Servitors and serf crew became shreds of meat under the hail of rounds. Abaddon followed in their wake, his helm display showing a scattering of threat runes that vanished as bolt rounds and Volkite beams found their marks. He reached the centre of the bridge as silence fell.
"Where is he?"
asked Layak, following Abaddon, ghost and shade light spiralling over him. His blade slaves flanked him, their swords drawn, their bodies bloated, shedding cinders and ashes with every step.
"Where are any of them?"
Abaddon turned, his mind shifting between possibilities. The bridge was silent, the few serf and servitor crew just those needed to keep the Lance of Heaven on course. No. To keep it on a trajectory that the War Oath could intercept. Hung out before them like a lure on a snare.
"Brother!"
shouted Ralkor. Abaddon had time to turn and to see a spinning mote of light beyond the viewports streaking towards them. The armour glass imploded in a wave of fire as the assault rams hit the Lance of Heaven's bridge. There were two of them, chisel-shaped blocks of armour and engines that carried five warriors in each tine of their forked hulls. each mounted melter weapons powerful enough to punch a hole in the skin of a warship. Striking the unshielded bridge, those weapons reduced half the chamber to glowing slag. The blast wave struck Abaddon and staggered him. Shards of wreckage and blobs of molten metal ricocheted from his battle plate. Tybar and his squad took the force of the hit and became fire and ash. The assault rams ripped through the bridge, embedding their prows deep in the deck. Sheets of metal scattered into the air. The assault rams' front hatches blew open. Warriors in white leaped to the glowing deck. Bolter and plasma fire lashed out. Sons of Horus fell. Gunfire blazed back. Layak and his blade slaves stood amongst the ruin, the pale fire and shadow that wreathed them, shredding bullets and debris to burning dust. Another assault ram ploughed through the hole left by the first two. Abaddon rose. Gouges and pits marked his terminator plate. The black lacquer of the Justerin had burned away, replaced by the red of cooling ceramite and black of soot. Erskar and Gedafron stood with him. Air rushed past them into the void. Inside Abaddon's helm, the noise of battle reached him as a vibration through his feet. He saw his enemy then, a warrior running amongst the white armoured figures, charging across the deck, plumed helm, Trigorian hunt marks running across the plates of his armour, Guandao spinning in his hands like the flash of lightning, like a bark of laughter as the rain fell. Jubal Khan, a warrior who had fought across the stars and left a reputation that few could hope to touch. Jubal, whom he had met on the spires of Nysek just before the counterattack by the Archdrake's horde. The Lord of Summer Lightning, the Death that Laughs. And here he was, a Lord of War left to fight almost alone in this abyss, left to fight and to die here. Abaddon began to run to greet him.
Psyker, he growled as he took the first stride. Kill the power generators!
He heard gunfire chop through the vox as his lieutenant answered.
It won't be clean, brother. Do it.
With pleasure and obedience, said Psykar,
and Abaddon heard his legion brother smiling. He was five strides across the deck. Jubal had seen him. The white scar whirled his blade out, and another of the sons of Horus was falling, helm split and blood burning on the Guando's power field.
Brace for gravity loss!
Shouted Erskar over the vox, firing a stream of heavy rounds into the white scars still leaping from the assault rams. A vibration rose through the deck. The few remaining lights cut out. Abaddon felt the lurch in his stomach as gravity vanished. His boots maglocked to the deck an instant later. One of the battered assault rams, still moving under the momentum of its impact, spun from the deck. Debris showered upwards. Half of the white scars rose into the air. Bolt rounds punched into them as they tumbled through the vanishing atmosphere. The rest maglocked their feet to the deck in time. Jubal kept moving. His stride slowed, but his speed still dazzling. Abaddon surged to meet him. Rounds blurred past him. The war shouts of the living and the dead filled his ears. His sword was in his hand, wreathed in lightning, his armour and blood and muscle flowing as one. Jubal's Guandao flashed out, reaching across the space between them. It was so fast that it might have been the glint of light from a mirror. Abaddon brought his sword up to meet it, but the weapons never met. Jubal flicked the Guandao back, as though the steel were a rope, and then slashed it out again. The blade edge kissed Abaddon's right gauntlet. The power field bit deep. A spike of pain flared up his arm. He spun his sword and sheared the Guandao away and struck back, turning the parry into an overhead cut. Jubal stepped away. The deck vibrated as the maglocks in their boots released and engaged once more. Abaddon struck again and again, pouring the force of each blow into the next, so that their strength grew like a storm sea clashing against the land. Jubal went back, pivoting and parrying. They were fighting on the deck before the wreck of the assault ram. Light flashed from the meeting of blades. Abaddon did not slow or step back. The battle was becoming silent as the last air drained from the bridge. The sound of his hearts filled his world, became the surge and murmur of war. Jubal went back again, fast. Abaddon saw an opening and thrust, but Jubal clamped his feet to the deck halfway through his step and slashed his blade back. It was not a cut that a savant of any blade school would recognize, but it struck Abaddon's sword arm just above the elbow. Razor edge and power field sliced through the thinner armour of the joint. Pain flared, and a bright string of red pearls bubbled into the vacuum. It punched into his mind and stole the instant before he realized that Jubal was open. Mind and body shunted the pain aside, and he cut. Jubal somehow met the killstroke. The force of impact jolted through Abaddon. Jubal released the maglocks holding him to the deck, and the impact of his strike sent him arcing over Abaddon's head. Jubal's feet found the deck, and his boots gripped him to the floor. He snapped the Guandao out as he landed. The long haft slid through his right hand, the tip reaching out to Abaddon like a thunderbolt. It was dazzling. From the first reversal of Abaddon's plan to kill the leader of the Falcon fleets, to this dance of blood and edges, this was war and killing on a level that rose to something beyond even the post-human. Abaddon would strike, and Jubal would slice, and bit by bit those cuts would bleed Abaddon, slow him, pull him down into more mistakes. They would follow this pattern on and on, cut after cut, and it would never cease, only flow into its next phase, like wind and storm rain split by the flash of lightning. Except it wouldn't. It could not. He knew Jubal, had known him before, and knew him better for these last moments. Abaddon raised his sword to meet the Guandao spearing towards him. To a human it would have been too fast to follow, but Jubal would have seen it, would have been waiting for it. The Guandao flicked aside. Power fields grazed each other in a plume of sparks. Jubal's feet locked to the floor as he turned his cut inside Abaddon's parry. Abaddon slammed his sword forwards, all his strength and all his skill focused in the blow. It struck the Guandao. Sheets of sparks flashed out. Jubal flinched back. The flow of his strikes shattered as force jolted through his weapon and up his arms. Abaddon activated the field of his power fist and slammed it forwards, palm open. The lightning-wreathed fingers closed on the Guandao with a flash of light. Jubal whirled back, but Abaddon had already read the movement. His sword thrust struck Jubal in the gut and cut upwards, soaring through armour, flesh and bone. Blood poured into the air, glistening, burning in the sword's power field. Jubal's arms swung, still bearing his broken weapon. Abaddon stepped back, pulling the sword free and kicking the corpse off his blade. And the Lord of Summer Lightning tumbled away, limbs suddenly slack, blood venting in spheres into the all but vanished air. Abaddon stood for a second, hearing his own breath inside his helm, watching the warrior he had killed. Then the sound rose up through the deck, vibrating through his armour. Abaddon's awareness snapped back, sharp and bright. Light was building in the front of one of the assault rams embedded in the deck. Abaddon had a stretching, momentary perception of the chamber before him, of the bolts and beams of energy reaching between the surviving white scars and the sons of Horus, the corpses already spinning through the air, the flicker of detonations out in the void beyond, and the light of the beam of heat building, ripping through the deck beneath his feet as the assault ram fired its magna melter. For the narrowest sliver of an instant, the deck plating seemed to contain it, glowing through red to white. Then the moment passed. Heat and molten metal exploded outwards. The melter beam sliced through the deck towards Abaddon. He felt the deck pitch as it began to crumple like parchment in a furnace. He was still moving, but these movements were slow, the last grains falling in an hourglass. The molten beam struck an invisible wall. Frost exploded to steam as it spread across the torn deck. The sound of screaming voices filled Abaddon's ears, shrieking and pleading. Shadows spiraled around him. He could smell burning parchment and incense. Zardulaak stepped to Abaddon's side. His hand was raised. A device burned on his palm. "Move," said Laak's voice in Abaddon's mind. Laak stood for another second, the hemisphere of shadow holding back the blast. Then Laak closed his hand. The shield of shadows and the melter beam vanished. Stillness filled the second. Then Laak opened his hand, and the fire leapt out like light trapped in a shuttered lamp. The assault ram exploded. Half of the deck vanished in a flash of white heat. A moment later, the gunfire ceased. Abaddon walked to Laak. Blood bubbled from under the priest's mask, dark and thick. Voices rose from the vox in Abaddon's ears, but he did not listen. He was looking at the grey armoured priest of the word bearers. He blinked his Vox channel to a direct link to Layak.
Saving a life forms a bond, first son of Horus, said Layak, looking up at him, the eyes of his horned and fanged mask glowing. Remember that? Always.